Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the candidate of the Green Party and the Socialist Party for president in 2020. And this podcast called Green Socialist Notes is about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist platform that Angela Walker and I ran on. And today we have a special guest, Rafael Bernabe. And Rafael is a member of the Puerto Rican Senate. He was elected statewide or islandwide in 2020 as a candidate of, the English translation is, the Citizens Victory Movement, which is a third party in Puerto Rico. And it's something that should give hope and inspiration to Greens in the United States. He had been the candidate for governor of Puerto Rico for the Working People's Party in 2012 and 2016. And besides being a longtime political activist in Puerto Rico, he's a professor of history and sociology at the University of Puerto Rico and a prolific author of many books and articles. He's a member of the organization Socialist Democracy, which is what you translate Democracia Socialista. My Spanish is not good, but and they publish an online magazine called Critico Momento or Critical Moment. And later on in this broadcast, we'll post some of his articles that he's published there that are about Puerto Rico and the Green New Deal and about the left and the war in Ukraine. Now, those articles are in Spanish, so if you don't read Spanish, you're going to have to get DeepL or Google Translate to read them in English, but I urge you to do so. They're really good articles and I think worth the effort. And we'll also post a link to about 15 articles he's published in Against the Current over about three decades now. Most of them addressing Puerto Rico or eco-socialism or both. So I've asked Rafael to speak about the struggles in Puerto Rico, including the advances of the left in his election, and then talk about the need for an internationalist perspective on solidarity with the people of Ukraine, speaking as someone who comes from the colonial context of Puerto Rico. So Rafael, the floor is yours. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. I will very briefly talk about the situation in Puerto Rico, with which perhaps not everybody is deeply familiar. I'm sure everybody's heard about Puerto Rico at one point or another. To put it very rapidly, Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States. It has been a colony of the United States since 1898, since the Spanish-American War. And that colonial control over Puerto Rico has many manifestations, many aspects to it, which I cannot go into, with given the time constraints that we have. I will emphasize that one of the main aspects of this colonial subordination has been its economic impact. That is to say, the economic structure of Puerto Rico has been largely determined by that colonial context. Ever since the beginning of the 20th century, most of the, or all of the, key sectors of Puerto Rico's economy have been controlled by U.S. corporations. They have determined what is produced in Puerto Rico and how it is produced. This was the case back in the early 20th century, when Puerto Rico was basically a sugar-producing agricultural economy. And it's still today, still the case today, when Puerto Rico is a semi-industrial economy in which, for example, the pharmaceutical industry and other high-tech industries play a fundamental role. So you have this massive presence of U.S. corporate capital, which controls most of Puerto Rico's economy, or most of the important sectors of Puerto Rico's economy. There are many aspects of trade and so on, which are still locally owned. A consequence of that fact is that Puerto Rico's economy has been very one-sided over the years. In one epoch, we had agricultural monoculture, and then we had the disappearance of agriculture and its replacement by a very fragmented process of industrialization. And it's a very, very vulnerable economy to the shifts in external markets. For example, if there's problems in the sugar market, in the international sugar market, then it used to be the case that Puerto Rico's economy would go into crisis because it basically depended on that economic sector, which occupied a very large part of Puerto Rico's economic existence. Another consequence of this situation is that a considerable portion of the income generated in Puerto Rico, or the wealth generated in Puerto Rico over the years, leaves the island in the forms of profits for these corporations. This is money, this is capital that is not reinvested in Puerto Rico. Therefore, it does not create employment in Puerto Rico. So one of the aspects that we've had over the years in Puerto Rico, over many decades, is the presence of mass unemployment. That is to say that this colonial economy that Puerto Rico has had has never been able to provide enough employment for its labor force. In the United States, it would be an indication of a major economic depression that you have a 10% or not to speak of 15% unemployment rate. Well, over many years, this was the normal unemployment rate in Puerto Rico. So what would be considered a depression situation like in the United States was kind of the normal situation in Puerto Rico. Another consequence of this situation, if you have mass unemployment, that means there's a very strong pressure downward pressure on wages, which explains why wages in Puerto Rico and living standards in Puerto Rico are still extremely low compared to the United States. Even if you have the free flow of Puerto Rico of people from Puerto Rico to the United States and the free flow of money and capital and so on between Puerto Rico and the United States, according to neoliberal or market theorists, you know, this would be the ideal conditions for Puerto Rico to move up and equalize itself with the United States. Well, that's not the case. This free movement of capital, free movement of money, free movement of people between Puerto Rico and the United States has never been able to eliminate the very, very wide gap between Puerto Rico and the United States in terms of employment and in terms of living standards. Right now, the per capita income of Puerto Rico, to give you an indication, is about half of that of the poorest state of the U.S., which is Mississippi. So it's not half of the per capita income of the U.S., it's half of the per capita income of the poorest state. So the colonial situation is a very strong, determinant of Puerto Rico's very backward situation regarding living standards compared to the United States. As a consequence of these very low living standards in Puerto Rico, very high unemployment in Puerto Rico, another aspect of Puerto Rican life, Puerto Rican reality, Puerto Rican history over the last century and this century is mass migration. That is, thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people have migrated from Puerto Rico at one point or another, seeking employment and seeking better living conditions in the United States, which explains why there's a very, very huge Puerto Rican diaspora in Illinois, in Chicago, in New York, in Connecticut, in Florida, in Texas, and many other places. And needless to say, over the years, most of these Puerto Rican migrants have joined the Puerto Rican working class, the United States working class, as one of the sectors which suffers particular forms of discrimination and more intense forms of exploitation. So, as I said, all of these things have changed over the years. We no longer have a sugar industry. Now we have a pharmaceutical industry. We no longer migrate necessarily, or in the majority of the people migrate to New York. Most people migrate to Florida, for example. So these things have changed. They have shifted over the years and over the decades. But the basic elements of Puerto Rico's colonial subordination, both political and economic, have remained constant. That's why decolonization is one of the main or the key demand to transform Puerto Rico's situation. Now, I don't want to, to speak for too long, but I should speak about the ecological consequences of this colonial relationship and the way that capitalism has developed in Puerto Rico. And I can enumerate some of them very rapidly, One of them is, of course, the initial imposition of the sugar monoculture. The ecological consequences of monoculture are well known around the world. And this was replaced, as I said, by a very fragmented form of industrialization. In both cases, both the sugar monoculture and the fragmented industrialization, you had the impossibility of having in Puerto Rico significant food production. It was an agricultural country which did not produce its own food. It depended on food imports, and it still depends on food imports with all the consequences that that brings, including the use of massive use of shipping to bring food into Puerto Rico, which has consequences for the environment. As part of the process of industrializations that we had, many of the installations that were established in Puerto Rico, the factories, there were food processing factories, shoe production, textile products, clothing production originally, and a little bit later on, sugar oil refineries and so on. All of this generated all sorts of pollution of land and water and the air. You had a massive construction industry after 1945, which extracted massive amounts of land and sand from the mountains, from the beaches, and so on. We had the tragic abandonment. Puerto Rico, up to the 1930s, had a significant production of electricity through hydroelectric means. We had a hydroelectric system. All of that was completely abandoned and replaced by fossil fuel production based on oil. We used to have a train system and a tramway or a streetcar system in Puerto Rico, which could have been expanded, and it was dismantled and completely replaced by the private automobile, and which also meant highway construction, which destroyed the landscape, destroyed habitats of different species in Puerto Rico. We had the adoption in Puerto Rico of the U.S. Model of suburban expansion, you know, what people call sprawl, which meant that in a relatively small island, it occupied a tremendous amount of territory, destroyed agricultural land, promoted accelerated erosion, sedimentation of riverbeds, all sorts of problems that were brought about by this unregulated horizontal expansion of urban construction, and so on and so forth. So we've had, even at this time, we are still producing some of our electricity with burning coal, if you would believe it, not only oil, but coal, which is even dirtier. So, you know, I could go on mentioning other aspects of these terrible ecological consequences of the type of development we had. Puerto Rico is a tropical island, has very beautiful beachfront and beach areas, many of which have suffered the consequences of construction, very close to the water, very close to the beach, very close to the coast, which has destroyed these areas as well. We have a very important tourist industry, a significant part of which depends on the operation of cruise ships, which cruise ships, as you may know, have a terrible impact on the ocean, on the coasts, and a major generator of CO2 and so on, and, you know, contributing to the warming of our planet. So there are many. Many ecological consequences of the development of capitalism in Puerto Rico and of colonial capitalism in Puerto Rico. Not to leave you with a very such a bleak image of our situation, all of these aspects of all of these consequences of U.S. Colonialism and of capitalism in Puerto Rico, none of them have gone uncontested. That is to say, all of them have provoked very important resistance movements. We have a very vibrant ecological and environmental movement in Puerto Rico. We've had it since the 1960s. In the 1960s, for example, there was a project to build the major mining operations in the center of the island, where you have important copper deposits. And there was a massive movement against the the realization of these mining projects, which were stopped, which would have been a major ecological disaster. There was a project in the 1970s to build a oil superport in Puerto Rico as part of a major petrochemical project. And again, there was a massive movement against the building of Scorcher Port, which would have been another major disaster. And it was stopped, fortunately. It wasn't carried out. And over the years, we've had many struggles. We have struggles right now against irresponsible building in the coastal zones, against the pollution caused by different industrial operations in Puerto Rico, and so on. And, you know, and I could go on with other struggles that we've had over the years. So there have been strong movements. There's a strong movement against the coal burning operations in where they occur in the south of Puerto Rico. This has a double aspect because you have the coal burning, and the burning of the coal generates these toxic ashes, which are then transported through the south of the island to another place where these ashes are deposited. So this process affects everybody, but it affects particularly the people who live nearby the coal burning plants, and it affects the people who live nearby the places where the ashes are deposited. So there have been movements in both ends of the process to stop the coal burning and to stop the deposit of the ashes where they are now placed, and so on. So all of these struggles have existed for the longest time. The movement that I belong to, and I conclude with this, and you can ask me, you know, any more details that you may want. The Movimiento Victoria Ciudadana is an electoral movement. It's an electoral party. It's a fairly recent creation. It was organized in 2019. And one of its main objectives is to become the electoral expression, the political vehicle for all of these struggles, not only environmental struggles, also labor struggles, women's struggles, student struggles. You know, I could go into all of these, but I won't unless you ask me to. And so the movement, the Citizens Victory movement, seeks to give political representation or elective office representation to all of these movements, so we can move beyond protesting against what the government and private corporations are doing to the island into actually imposing or carrying out policies contrary to what these privileged interests have been doing over, you know, so many years. And we've had relative success for a movement that was just organized and participated in its first elections. We elected two senators and two representatives. The Senate of Puerto Rico has 27 members, so we have two out of 27 senators, a minority, but given the fragmented representation that we have now, we have five parties in the Senate. It's not insignificant. And the same thing applies to the House, where there's, I believe, 52 members, and two of which are members of Victoria Ciudadana. Plus, we were very close. In fact, we think we are convinced that we won the mayoralty of San Juan, which is the capital city of San Juan. It was stolen from us. You know, we lost, officially, we lost by kind of 3,000 votes or something like that. We are, you know, if we didn't win, we were very close to winning. So it shows, this would be the equivalent of some, you know, a progressive party winning New York or major city in the United States. Even more so, because San Juan has a greater, it's a bigger chunk of Puerto Rico's population than any big city in the U.S. would be of the total population of the U.S. And so it's a very significant political force in Puerto Rico right now. And we are very happy about that. And we are, you know, building towards the elections of 2024. Through our constant intervention in many of the struggles that I have mentioned. So I gave you a lot of detail. I've spoken too much. I'm going to shut up, and you can ask me anything you want, you know, to if you want me to elaborate on any of these things I've said.
Okay, thank you, Rafael. At some point, I'd like you to talk about Ukraine and solidarity.
Oh,
But I did see some questions in the chat. So you want to go into that first, and then we'll just
Yeah, sure. Let's talk about Puerto Rico. Yeah, about these questions, then we can address the other.
Okay, we need critical thinking question. Is Puerto Rico a place where some rich people go to dodge taxes? I mean, Peter Schiff lives there, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. Ever since the brief history of this is ever since 1947, you know, right after the World War II, the government of Puerto Rico adopted a policy, the central aspect of the Puerto Rico's government economic promotion policy was what they call, or we call, tax exemption. That is to say, they offered U.S. corporations the opportunity of coming to Puerto Rico, of investing in Puerto Rico, without having to pay, basically having to pay taxes in Puerto Rico. And since they don't have to pay federal taxes while they operate in Puerto Rico, or while they operated in Puerto Rico, they basically could function in a tax-free environment. And they could enter the U.S. market freely, because there's free trade between Puerto Rico and the United States, and they could pay the lowest wages with, you know, under the U.S. flag, as they used to say. So you have very low wages, you have free entry to the U.S. market, and you have a tax-free environment. So that was a very attractive proposition to many U.S. manufacturing enterprises who invested in Puerto Rico, and that's why you had this process of semi-industrialization over the 1950s and over the 1960s and into the 1970s. But at that moment, as I said, tax exemption was basically geared towards attracting manufacturing industrial investment into Puerto Rico, which it did. And it created, you know, you can make many criticisms, I do, of the limits of this economic strategy, which I mentioned before. You know, the outflow of profits, it never really generated enough employment in the island and so on. But it still generated economic growth, and it generated employment and so on. What we've had in recent years is that this policy has basically stopped functioning for reasons that we can go into. But it basically stopped functioning. That is, it stopped attracting U.S. Corporate investments into manufacturing. One of the things was that the U.S. Congress decided to eliminate most of the federal tax exemption. That is to say, these enterprises now have to pay more federal taxes than they used to have to pay, and so on. But I won't go into all the details. The fact is that over the last two decades or so, manufacturing employment in Puerto Rico collapsed from about 180,000 jobs to about half of that, 70,000, 80,000 jobs. Now, the government of Puerto Rico in recent years, I'm going to the question that you asked, since 2010, 2011, generated or created or adopted a new version of this tax exemption policy, which was the tax exemption policy carried to the extreme, or carried to the absurd, many of us would say, which was a measure to attract U.S. investors to relocate to Puerto Rico, that is to come and live in Puerto Rico. And by dint of the fact that they relocated in Puerto Rico, that they could prove that they lived in Puerto Rico most of the years. They have to live in Puerto Rico for 180 days every year, or at least demonstrate that they live in Puerto Rico, and they have expenses in Puerto Rico. They buy a house in Puerto Rico and so on. They have a residence in Puerto Rico. As a result of that fact that they live in Puerto Rico, they don't have to pay taxes in Puerto Rico, nor do they have to pay taxes, you know, where they're coming from. So if you're a millionaire, you live in New York or you live in California, you have to pay taxes in those states. You move to Puerto Rico, you no longer have to pay taxes in New York or California, nor do you have to pay taxes in Puerto Rico, so you don't have to pay taxes. So you live in Puerto Rico and you pay no taxes to anybody. It's a tax avoidance location. And in return for that privilege, you don't have to do anything. That is to say, these people only have to show that they live in Puerto Rico. They don't have to create one job. They don't have to build a factory. At least in the past, you know, they have, you had to have some investment in Puerto Rico. You have to invest and make a factory and employ some people. These people don't have to do anything. They just buy a big house in Puerto Rico and they resettle in Puerto Rico for part of the year, or they don't. They have somebody in Puerto Rico who goes around with their credit card, a credit card on their name, you know, buying things here and there so they can say or show that they live in Puerto Rico, when in fact they don't. And so they don't get to pay taxes anywhere, and they live in Puerto Rico. They don't have to basically do anything in return, you know. The more cynical defenders of this policy, you know, will argue that at least they, you know, they have to pay, you know, they have to have a gardener to tend to their gardens, and they have to have somebody to, you know, to clean the house, and they have to have a chauffeur to drive them around and so on. So, you know, they create, you know, 5 or 6 jobs for some people. But, you know, it's absurd that this type of policy is going to generate any type of significant economic development in Puerto Rico. It does nothing good for Puerto Rico. And it allows these irresponsible characters to avoid paying taxes, you know, where they are coming from. One of the other consequences of this policy has been that one of the things in which some of these persons have engaged, one of the activities, is to buy very depressed properties in Puerto Rico. We've had an economic crisis for the longest time. So you had very large urban areas, or even very large beachfront properties, which are very depressed. They can buy them at a very low price, and they can refurbish them as hotels or Airbnbs and so on and so forth, in which they do invest. Which means that rents and costs of living in these areas goes up, because they start to be geared, activity starts to be geared to these very high income people who come into the island. And it means displacement of communities. One of the big movements that we had in Puerto Rico right now, as I mentioned before, is a movement against denouncing the displacement of. Okay, I was talking about gentrification. Did you hear that part, or?
I think that's where you should take off.
Okay, from. Yeah, I was concluding about the effects of this policy of attracting these millionaires to Puerto Rico to reside in Puerto Rico. They don't contribute significantly to Puerto Rico's economic growth. What they do contribute is to the displacement of many communities, because they buy up properties, depressed properties in Puerto Rico. Sometimes they refurbish them, reconstruct them, then turn them into high rent places or tourist locations. And they gear the whole economy of that spot towards these high income visitors or new residents in the island. That means that rents go up and cost of living goes up, and it leads to the displacement of the historical inhabitants or residents of these areas. So you have these relatively poor historical communities that have lived in areas in Puerto Rico. You know, I don't know how familiar you are with the geography of Puerto Rico, but the coastal areas in the north, towns like Dorado or Santurce, which is a very beautiful area in the center of San Juan itself, and so on. And they are displacing communities from these areas. One of the big movements that we've had in recent years is a movement denouncing this process of displacement, this process of gentrification, which it's similar to the process of gentrification that you know very well in cities of the United States, with the added element that here it's also a colonial process. That is to say, it's not only that the rich displace the poor from very attractive areas, but that it's the rich coming from outside who are displacing communities in Puerto Rico as a result of this process of gentrification. And as I said before, none of this has gone uncontested. There's a strong movement denouncing these tax policies which promote or help along this process of gentrification. But short answer to the question is absolutely yes. Puerto Rico has become a haven for people who want to avoid paying taxes where they should be paying them. And they, this is not good for the people of the U.S. Because it provides an escape route for millionaires in the states not to pay taxes. And it's not good for the people of Puerto Rico either, because the consequences for the economy of Puerto Rico are either no, they have no impact on our growth, or they are negative because they promote such processes as the one I described just now.
Okay, this should be Frankie Lee. Howie and Rafael, how can the shark jaws of the PROMESA board be pried from Puerto Rico? And in my opinion, be eliminated as an entity?
Absolutely, yes. Maybe I should explain first to some of our viewers what the PROMESA board is, because some of them may not be familiar with. As I mentioned before, the economy of Puerto Rico has been in a crisis ever since at least 2005, 2006. And the economy stopped growing. The employment stopped expanding. In fact, about 200,000 jobs were lost over a decade in Puerto Rico. One of the consequences of that was for the first time between 2010 and 2020, for the first time since they have been keeping censuses in Puerto Rico, population went down, because so many people left the island, they couldn't make a living in Puerto Rico anymore. So as the economy went into deep crisis, one of the responses of the government, besides these absurd tax policies I mentioned just before, one of the actions of the government was to issue more debt, that is to borrow more money, borrow an increasing amount of money. And that increasing amount of money led to a debt crisis, that is to say, by 2015, as many of us had predicted, it was, you know, you don't have to be a financial wizard to, you know, to predict that. If the economy is not growing and the government income is not growing and you keep borrowing more money, there will become a moment in which you will not be able to pay back this money to service this debt. And that moment came in 2015, when the government of Puerto Rico had to default on its debt because it couldn't pay it anymore. And as a result of that, it was evident that the debt of Puerto Rico would have to be renegotiated. It could not be paid. There was no way it could be paid. It had to be renegotiated. The issue was how it was going to be renegotiated and in the interests of who was it going to be renegotiated. Of course, we wanted it to be renegotiated in terms of the benefit of the Puerto Rican people, in the interests of the Puerto Rican people, so they could reconstruct their economy. Needless to say, the creditors of Puerto Rico, the big Wall Street investors, had no interest in that. They had an interest in collecting as much as possible of this debt. They knew themselves that they couldn't collect everything, but they want to collect as much as possible. Now, the U.S. Congress and the U.S. executive under Obama, I must point out, did their work to make sure that the second outcome was the one that came through. And they approved legislation, which is called PROMESA, the Puerto Rico Oversight, Puerto Rico. And this legislation created a board, which we call La Junta, the control board, we call it. Officially, it's called the Oversight Board. And this board, basically, it's named by Congress and the president. We don't have any role in electing the members of this junta. The members of this junta, of this board, basically have the power to take over Puerto Rico's government. That is to say, they can oversee Puerto Rico's budget. They can oversee where we spend money or we don't spend money, and so on and so forth. For example, they have decided that the budget of the University of Puerto Rico must be lowered, and they have lowered the budget of the University of Puerto Rico to about half of what it was 7 or 8 years ago. They have basically strangled the University of Puerto Rico. I know this very well because I work there, and so on and so forth. Very recently, for example, we've had them in 2017, The government of Puerto Rico approved labor legislation, which eliminated many important labor protections that we have in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico, over the years, as a result of the struggles of the labor movement, has had fairly advanced labor legislation, which was most of which, or significant parts of which, were wiped out in 2017, which is very anti-labor law that was approved at the time. And recently, the legislature of Puerto Rico, in good part thanks to the work of the left fact sectors in the Puerto Rico legislature, the Independence Party, the Citizens Victory Movement, to which I belong, and so forth, we were able to approve legislation which restored not all, but a significant portion of the rights that were eliminated in 2017. Well, the board overruled. This law was approved by the legislature. It was signed by the governor. It should be law in Puerto Rico. But the board has the legal right to say, no, this legislation is null because it would negatively affect the economy of Puerto Rico, and therefore we block it. And this is still in court, but so far the federal courts have reasserted the right of the board to overrule legislation approved by the governor, by the government of Puerto Rico. So this is colonialism, you know, colonialism square, or colonialism in steroids, you know, so that even the limited powers of the legislature of Puerto Rico are now limited by the powers of this junta, this board created by the PROMESA Act back in 2016. So yes, absolutely. One of the demands that we have to raise is the overturn, the repeal of the PROMESA Act, and with it, the elimination of this board, which is anti-democratic, it is colonial, and it's counterproductive because of the policies that it imposes on the Puerto Rican people are very destructive, and not policies that promote economic development by any means. They do promote the collection of the maximum amount of the debt in favor of the creditors, instead of prioritizing the needs of the Puerto Rican people. So as I said before, sometimes many people ask me in conversations such as this, what demands should progressive people in the US, people of the left in the US, should raise regarding Puerto Rico? Well, one of them evidently is decolonization, which I already mentioned before, and one of them should be repeal of the PROMESA Act, and with it the elimination of this board. Another one would be that Congress provide a significant amount of funds for the economic reconstruction of Puerto Rico, since Congress is at least in significant part responsible for the perpetuation of the colonial relationship, which is the fundamental cause for Puerto Rico's economic woes over the years.
Scout Trooper 164, Rafael, what are your views on the Ukraine war?
Okay, my views on the Ukraine war. Well, that's a topic for a whole debate, but I would say my views are more or less guided by three fundamental principles, which I've defended for the longest time. This is not something that I formulated as a result of the Ukraine war, but it's my views, as I said, ever since I became active in the socialist movement and in the independence movement, which is, one is opposition to rejection or the struggle against imperialism in all of its forms, including colonialism, but not only. Secondly, a defense of the right of all peoples to self-determination, which is kind of a consequence of the first principle. We oppose imperialism and we defend the rights of all people, victims of any form of imperialism, the right of peoples to self-determination. And thirdly, we support the struggles of all exploited and oppressed peoples in all countries and in all states. Now, I think that if we abide by these three basic ideas, we can make our way through these very complex situations that exist around the world today in the Ukraine and in Ukraine, and not only in Ukraine. So applying these three basic principles, I think we have to recognize that we have to struggle against U.S. imperialism. We have to struggle against NATO imperialism. We have to denounce them. We have to fight against them. We have to expose them. I think there's little disagreement on that on the left. But I think we also have to recognize that there are other imperialisms with besides NATO imperialism and U.S. imperialism. And I think there is, in this case, definitely a Russian imperialism. Russia is a capitalist state. Capitalism was restored in Russia, as we all know, back in the 1990s. We have an oligarchic capitalist class that rules there. It rules in its own interests, and it seeks to influence other territories, conquer other territories, subordinate other territories, as all imperialisms do. So while we fight against U.S. imperialism, as I do fight against U.S. imperialism in Puerto Rico, we have to also oppose other imperialist projects, such as, I think, the invasion of the Ukraine. Now, that doesn't mean that I have to agree with the government of Zelensky or agree with its policies or agree with its discourse or anything like that. It means I support the Ukrainian people against this invasion. And I can accompany that with all sorts of criticisms of the Zelensky government, which I do. Sometimes I draw an analogy with the situation in the 1930s when Japan invaded China. I think all progressive people around the world were with China in that conflict, even though China was governed at that time, was ruled at that time by the government of Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang, which was a murderous, reactionary, anti-working class, anti-communist, anti-socialist, corrupt regime that no progressive person could support. But nevertheless, we were with China against Japanese imperialism. And the fact that Chiang Kai-shek may receive aid from the United States or France or Great Britain and so on did not impede us to be with China against Japanese imperialism. And the fact that we oppose Japanese U.S. imperialism in the Philippines, for example, and the Pacific, doesn't mean we side with Japanese imperialism just because it is in conflict with U.S. imperialism. And I don't see any reason why that logic is not applicable to the present situation. We oppose NATO imperialism, we oppose U.S. imperialism, but we also oppose other imperialisms, and we defend the right of the Ukrainian people to self-determination. Doesn't mean we necessarily agree with the present government of the Ukraine. So my position is that as consistent anti-imperialists, we have to oppose the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. We have to support the right of the Ukraine to defend itself. And we have to not by one moment accept as a result of that any reactionary policies that the present government of the Ukraine may adopt. If the government of the Ukraine adopts a privatization policy or an anti-working class policy and so on, we will denounce that. We will denounce that. But the fact that we may object to Zelensky's government in one way or another doesn't justify that we support the Russian invasion. I hear some progressive people point out the terrible things that NATO and the United States imperialism does, which I agree completely with. But that's a good reason to oppose NATO imperialism. It's not a good reason to support Russian imperialism. In the same fashion, I hear some progressives talk about all the terrible things that the government of Zelensky may have or may have not done. Again, that's a good reason, if they are true, not to support the government of Zelensky. But it's not a good reason to support the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. Getting rid of a bad government in the Ukraine, I think, is a task of the Ukrainian people, not of anybody else who, adjudicates another external power that adjudicates to itself the right to do so. You know, it's similar to what we've done in the past with other cases. I mean, I don't think, at least I didn't support the government of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. I have no illusions about that government, but I opposed the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And I opposed it because I think that getting rid of Saddam Hussein was a task for the Iraqi people. It was not something that the United States had the right to use. The problems with Saddam Hussein is not a valid excuse for the U.S. government to intervene and overthrow the government of Iraq. And, you know, empires have always used this type of logic. You know, this government is bad, this government is objectionable, this government is anti-democratic, this government is fascist, and therefore we can invade. And we may even agree that some of these governments are bad, but that doesn't give imperialists the right to intervene. So, as I said, those three principles, I try to apply them consistently everywhere. I try to apply them consistently, you know, in the case of Iraq, in the case of Afghanistan, in the case of Niger today, and, you know, many other places. We are against imperialism. We are for the right of peoples to self-determination. And within every state and country and nation, whether oppressed or dominant, we are for the struggles of the exploited and the struggles of the oppressed. And I think we have to abide by these three basic ideas and make our way through very complex conjunctures by remaining loyal to them.
Robert Norris, would statehood or independence be better for Puerto Rico? And let me add to that, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has a bill to set up a process for Puerto Rico to decide that status. And what do you think of that bill?
Okay, yes. I think this question is very important and has several aspects to it. Let me begin by this. What do I think should be the position of progressives in the U.S., which I suspect most of our audience belongs to that group? I think that the demand has to be raised is for self-determination, that is, for the Puerto Rican people to be able to decide what future they want for Puerto Rico. And I say that because there is a tendency within the U.S. left, I don't think it's the majority tendency, but it's there, or many progressive sectors in the U.S., to see statehood as the solution. And it's done, I think, in many cases with the best of intentions, because it's based on an analogy, perhaps, with the case of African Americans or Black people in the United States. That is to say, they have been discriminated, they have been oppressed, and the solution to that situation of oppression and so on is to grant them or to assure them in reality equal rights with the rest of the citizens to the United States. So with that analogy, you can argue, some people argue, no, Puerto Ricans are ruled by the U.S., but they have no right to elect congressmen. They don't have right to vote for the president of the U.S. They have no say in the government that controls them. And the way to go beyond that, the way to solve that problem, is to grant them those rights. That is, let's make Puerto Rico a state, and then they will have all the rights that the states have. They can, you know, they can vote for Congress, they can elect the president, and so on and so forth, and they will have equal rights with the rest of the U.S. citizens. And that's a legitimate position to defend. I don't agree with it. I will explain why in a minute. But the main point that has to be made is that the situation of Puerto Rico can have that solution. You can make Puerto Rico a state. Yes, that's an option. But you can also make Puerto Rico an independent country. Puerto Rico can also become an independent country, a sovereign country, hopefully in a relationship of cooperation and collaboration with all other countries, including the United States. Or you can have some sort of independent Puerto Rico in some sort of association arrangement with the United States. These are three options that have widespread support in Puerto Rico: independence, association, and statehood. So the American left, I think, should not defend, and this is something I should add, for the Puerto Ricans to decide, like which way we go, independence, association, or statehood, is something not for the U.S. to decide, not even for the U.S. left to decide, but for Puerto Rico to decide. So I think from the United States, what we must or should defend is the right of Puerto Rico to decide what Puerto Rico should become. Whether it goes in one direction or another, that's for the Puerto Rican people to determine and decide. So I think we need to defend a process of real self-determination for Puerto Rico. The AOC project, the legislation presented by AOC, by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, goes in that direction, and it's a fairly good legislation. I mean, the original version is a version that we in the, I personally and the movement I belong to, we have supported it critically. That is to say, we have some amendments, we think they could be improved, but basically the notion of that project is that Puerto Rico is a colony, Puerto Rico needs to decolonize, and the way to do that is to hold a convention in Puerto Rico. We call it the Status Convention, in which Puerto Rican people elect delegates to this convention who may be defenders of different status options. And that convention, elected by the Puerto Rican people, which is something, an idea that comes from Puerto Rico, this is a proposal that we've made for the longest time, this convention elected by the Puerto Rican people negotiates with Congress different non-colonial options, which are then presented to the Puerto Rican people in a plebiscite, and the Puerto Rican people decide what they want to do. And what the bill adds to that is that it establishes a commission of Congress to negotiate with the Convention of Puerto Rico to negotiate these non-colonial options. Now, we think that this bill would provide a relatively appropriate framework to work out a solution to Puerto Rico's colonial problem. Now, what to go to the question that we asked. I mean, as I said, there are three options. Which one do I think would be better for Puerto Rico? Well, I am a supporter of independence. Would statehood be better? Well, statehood would bring several things to Puerto Rico, or rather, statehood means several things for Puerto Rico. It means that Puerto Ricans are or would be, or would remain U.S. citizens. It means that Puerto Ricans can go in freely and come back freely from the United States. They can move freely between Puerto Rico and the United States. It means that capital and money and commodities can move freely between Puerto Rico and the United States. It means that the U.S. dollar will remain Puerto Rico's coin, and so on and so forth. Now, all of these things we already have. All of these things we've had for a century and 20 years. Ever since 1900, we've had most of these things. Statehood, citizenship since 1917. All of these things we've had for more than a century. So the situation in Puerto Rico is not going to be solved by perpetuating the things that we've had for a century. These things are not, in any case, you could argue that this dispositions are part of the problem. The terrible economic crisis that we have in Puerto Rico is the result of these conditions. So perpetuating them, I don't see how that is going to improve our situation. That is to say, if Puerto Rico didn't have the dollar, if Puerto Rico didn't have free trade with the U.S., if Puerto Rico didn't have U.S. citizenship, if Puerto Rico didn't have free entry into the U.S., then somebody could conceivably argue, well, with these things, we are going to solve Puerto Rico's problems. But we have all of these things, and our problems are there. So the only argument that can be made in favor of statehood is that it will imply a major or a significant growth in the amount of federal funds, of U.S. funds that flow into Puerto Rico. Now, these funds have flowed into Puerto Rico for the longest time as well. And what they do is that they are kind of a compensation for the non-functioning of the Puerto Rico's economy. Puerto Rico's colonial economy doesn't function. Most people are poor people. 45% of the people in Puerto Rico live below the poverty level. I think it's about 15% in the U.S. Well, Puerto Rico is 45% of the people are below the official poverty level. So you have massive amounts of federal funds that come into Puerto Rico to somehow mitigate the impact of the colonial economy. And with statehood, we would have an increase in this amount of mitigation funds. But we don't want more mitigation for colonialism. We want to end this colonial structure. So I think that statehood is not a convincing proposition. I support independence for Puerto Rico, which again does not imply that we go into a deep end, that we have no more relationship with the United States. the fact is that Puerto Rico will become independent and that it will still have major economic relations with the United States, its neighbor. And we've had a very close relationship for 120 years. More than half of the people who identify as Puerto Ricans live in the United States. So we're going to have, even on the independence, some sort of logical, reasonable migratory agreements to deal with this reality. You know, you cannot expect an independent Puerto Rico to simply forget and erase the trace, the consequences of 120 years of U.S. colonialism and so on. But I think independence would give the people of Puerto Rico and the government of Puerto Rico the power to engage, to develop, to promote all the policies that the Puerto Rican people may need in order to ensure their you know, their best interests. Again, I would hope in collaboration with other peoples, including the United States. And it's my... So, yeah. Well, I was concluding by saying that I think the people in the progressive sectors, the left sectors in the U.S., should, as part of what I've just said, raise the demand for, I guess, would be the equivalent regarding Puerto Rico of reparations. That is to say that Congress has the duty to help, to support, to provide hospitable, to provide favorable conditions for the development of an independent Puerto Rico. Congress owes the Puerto Rican people the opportunity to reconstruct its society, its economy, as a sovereign people. And that would be the fair thing to do, the just thing to do. Doesn't mean that's what's going to happen, but that's what we should demand. And yeah, that's why I favor independence. Needless to say, as a socialist, I think that independence should be the vehicle for very deep social transformation. It's not a question of making Puerto Rico independent and just leaving it at that. There are many independent countries around us that are doing very badly because they are capitalist and neoliberal independent countries, which policies of which, or dominant policies of which affect the people very negatively. And that's definitely not what we want. And if I may conclude by saying, you know, how far we achieve what we need to achieve in Puerto Rico in progressive terms depends in no little part on the struggles in the United States. This is always something that I emphasize. You know, if progressive forces in the U.S., such as the Green Party and other sectors, become stronger and they become more influential and they come to determine more deeply what happens in the U.S. or what policies the U.S. government adopts, that's very favorable for our progressive program in Puerto Rico. If, on the other hand, the reactionary, capitalist, corporate, racist wing of American society is ever more dominant, then the for justice and decolonization in Puerto Rico becomes much more difficult. So the strengthening of the struggles, progressive struggles in the U.S. and in Puerto Rico should go together. And decolonization and justice for Puerto Rico should be an important point within the agenda of the American left. That is sometimes the case in some sectors, and sometimes Puerto Rico tends to be forgotten, and that's unfortunate. If I make a criticism, if I may make a controversial criticism, for example, I was looking at the program in an activity which I participated in the past, which I think is very good, and it's very good right now this year, this socialism conference in Chicago soon in the next few days. And it's very interesting, many interesting forums and conferences and so on. I won't be able to participate. I wish I could, but there's not, as I saw, there's not one forum, there's not one table, there is not one conversation about the situation in Puerto Rico and the situation in the U.S. largest colony. And I think that's not good. It's not good. You know, any progressive activity or forum like this one you have in here should have, you know, a little space, at least a little space, if not a major space, to discuss about the situation in Puerto Rico and so on. So that's a friendly criticism to people who I like and I love and I collaborated with very much in the past, but it's not good to overlook this very important issue as part of the debate within the American left. That's why I think it's to the merit of your podcast that you are discussing, you know, Puerto Rico today.
Well, our hour is up, and I know we got a dozen questions we didn't get to.
I talk too much, I know.
But they're good, thorough answers, and I think people appreciated it. I certainly did. I agree with your criticism of Socialism 2023. I've tried to get panels on independent politics in there in the past, and they seem to want to avoid that subject. The case of Puerto Rico, I don't think because it's controversial. It's because it's not as front and center as it should be, given the U.S. particular responsibility for the status of Puerto Rico. And then, you know, there are other questions that never get discussed, like Indonesia's colonization of West Papua, which is being bombed right now by the Indonesian military, which gets the backing of the U.S. military. That's another case of occupation and colonialism that Americans who tend to be insular are not even aware of. And the Papua New Guinea Green Party is very aware of it. They're trying to extend their party into West Papua. And they're just trying to raise a few thousand dollars, and they're having a hell of a time given how poor that country is. In any case, I agree. It's unfortunately, Greens don't have much sway in whoever's planning Socialism 2023. So I wanted to point out that in the chat were links to Rafael's articles. Some of them have English titles, but they're actually in Spanish. He has a couple on Ukraine and a couple on Puerto Rico and the Green New Deal that I think people here, given our questions and our audience, would be especially interested in. So I urge you to, you know, capture those. I think it's going to be online where YouTube posts this as well in the explanation below. So I just wanted to call your attention to that. And I'm glad we got through this. We had a little freeze up a couple times, but it wasn't like yesterday when the power was out there for 7-8 hours and a problem that Puerto Rico had to deal with. So I'm glad we got through that. So once again, Rafael, thank you. And one thing Rafael's written a lot about is eco-socialism. So maybe we can have you back to just have a discussion of that in the future. I know a lot of people in the audience want to talk about that. So we'll be here next week, next Saturday. I may have a guest. I have a number of people who have said they want to come on, and they're trying to pick a date. And one of them may pick next week. I'm not sure yet. If not, there's plenty of news we can discuss. And so until next week, have a good week, everybody. Try to stay cool in this record-breaking weather. We got power, love.